The Democracy Project, A History, A Crisis, A Movement, by David Graeber. Chapter 5, Breaking the Spell. In the fall of 2011, most of us felt we were standing in the middle of a global revolution. Everything was happening almost unimaginably rapidly, with a wave of unrest that began in Tunisia suddenly engulfing the world, threatening everywhere. We were seeing sympathy demonstrations in China, and almost daily new occupations in places like Nigeria and Pakistan. In retrospect, of course, there was no way things could really continue at such a pace. It was as if, just as all the international security structures designed to head off such mass resistance, and which, since the crash of 2008, had been churning out endless studies and working papers on the likelihood of food riots and global unrest, had finally convinced themselves, rather incredulously, that nothing significant was really going to happen. It did. And now that it had, they were standing there gaping just as incredulously. Still, when the inevitable wave of repression came, it left many of us in temporary confusion. We'd expected to see the truncheons come out eventually. What surprised many of us was the reaction of our liberal allies. America, after all, sees itself not as a nation united by any particular ethnic origin, but as a people united by their freedoms. And these were the very people who ordinarily put themselves forth as those freedoms' most stalwart defenders. The fact they proved happy instead to see civil liberties as so many bargaining chips to be defended only if strategically convenient was sobering. Even to many anarchists like me who have come to expect almost nothing else from the liberal establishment. The effect was all the more distressing because so many of those left in the lurch had just directly experienced violence. These were young men and women who'd been first drawn into a euphoric sense of almost unlimited possibility, but who now had to deal with vivid memories of watching their library, so lovingly assembled, trashed, and sent off to the incinerators by laughing patrolmen, of seeing their dearest friends beaten with sticks and shackled as the mainstream media dutifully refused to enter the perimeter, unable to do anything to help them, of seeing friends maced in the face having to face the prospect of lifelong respiratory problems, of having to scramble to find housing for people whose life possessions, however modest, had been destroyed by agents of the state, led to a bubbling up of every conceivable tension and ill feeling that had been repressed or ignored in the weeks previous when organizing and defending the camps had given us such obvious common purpose. For a month or so, the New York General Assembly and Spokes Council fell into almost complete dysfunction. There were near fistfights at some meetings, screaming fits, ringing cries of racism, an endless tangle of overlapping crises over tactics, organization, and money, and accusations on everything from police infiltration to narcissistic personality disorder. At moments like this, even professional optimists like myself are tempted to feel cynical. But, periodically, with striking regularity, actually, I found myself confronted with reminders of just how much I've already taken for granted. A few weeks after the evictions, after one typically fretful hallway conference, I met a solemn, bearded man, perhaps 35 years old, conservatively dressed, who remarked, "You know, it doesn't really matter if the May Day actions come off at all. I mean, like anyone, I'm hoping they will, but even if it does, even if we never reoccupy, even if it all were to end today, as far as I'm concerned, you guys have already changed everything. For me, anyway. I think we're looking at the beginning of a transformation of American culture." "Really? But how many people has it really reached?" "Well, the thing is, for anyone who has, you can't really go back to thinking about things the way you did before. I notice it in my job. Here we might spend all our time complaining about meetings, but just try to go back to the real world again if you'd never experienced a democratic meeting before. You go back to work and suddenly it's like, wait a minute. This is just completely ridiculous. And you talk to your friends, your sister, your parents, and saying, well, what else is there we've just assumed is the only way you can do something that might seem just as stupid if we didn't just take it for granted? You might be surprised. A lot of people are asking that sort of thing." And I thought, could it be that's all a revolution really is? When that starts to happen? That is, if it really has... It's a much vexed question. What is a revolution? We used to think we knew. Revolutions were seizures of power by some kind of popular forces aiming to transform the very nature of the political, social, and economic system in the country in which the revolution took place, usually according to some visionary dream of a just society. Nowadays, we live in an age when, if rebel armies do come sweeping into a city, or mass uprisings overthrow a dictator, it's unlikely to have any such implications when profound social transformation does occur, as with, say, the rise of feminism, it's likely to take an entirely different form. It's not that revolutionary dreams aren't out there, but contemporary revolutionaries rarely think they can bring them into being by some modern-day equivalent of storming the Bastille. At moments like this, it generally pays to go back to the history one already knows and ask, were revolutions ever really what we thought them to be? For me, the person who has done this the most effectively is the great world historian Emanuel Wallerstein. He argues that for the last quarter millennium or so, revolutions have consisted above all of planet-wide transformations of political common sense. Already by the time of the French Revolution, Wallerstein notes, there is a single world market, and increasingly a single world political system as well, dominated by the huge colonial empires. As a result, the storming of the Bastille in Paris could well end up having effects on Denmark or even Egypt, just as profound as on France itself. In some cases, even more so. Hence he speaks of the World Revolution of 1789, followed by the World Revolution of 1848, which saw revolutions break out almost simultaneously in 50 countries, from Wallachia to Brazil. In no case did the revolutionaries succeed in taking power, but afterward, institutions inspired by the French Revolution, notably universal systems of primary education, were put in place pretty much everywhere. Similarly, the Russian Revolution of 1917 was a world revolution ultimately responsible for the New Deal and European welfare states as much as Soviet communism. The last in the series was the World Revolution of 1968, which, much like 1848, broke out almost everywhere from China to Mexico, seized power nowhere, but nonetheless changed everything. This was a revolution against state bureaucracies and for the inseparability of personal and political liberation, whose most lasting legacy will likely be the birth of modern feminism. Revolutions are thus planetary phenomena, but there is more. What they really do is transform basic assumptions about what politics is ultimately about. In the wake of a revolution, ideas that had been considered veritably lunatic fringe quickly become the accepted currency of debate. Before the French Revolution, the idea that change is good, that government policy is the proper way to manage it, and that governments derive their authority from an entity called the people were considered the sorts of things one might hear from crackpots and demagogues, or at best a handful of free-thinking intellectuals who spend their time debating in cafes. A generation later, even the stuffiest magistrates, priests, and headmasters had to at least pay lip service to these ideas. Before long, we had reached the situation we are in today, where it's necessary to lay the terms out, as I just did, for anyone to even notice they are there. They become common sense, the very grounds of political discussion. Until 1968, most world revolutions really just introduced practical refinements, widening the franchise, introducing universal primary education, the welfare state. The World Revolution of 1968, in contrast, whether it took the form it did in China, of a revolt by students and young cadres supporting Mao's call for a cultural revolution, or Berkeley in New York, where it marked an alliance of students, dropouts, and cultural rebels, or even Paris, where it was an alliance of students and workers, it was in the same initial spirit, a rebellion against bureaucracy, conformity, of anything that fettered the human imagination, a project for the revolutionizing not just a political or economic life, but every aspect of human existence. As a result, in most cases, the rebels didn't even try to take over the apparatus of state. They saw that apparatus as itself the problem. It's fashionable nowadays to view the social movement of the late 1960s as an embarrassing failure. A case can surely be made for that view. It's certainly true that in the political sphere, the immediate beneficiary of any widespread change in political common sense, a prioritizing of ideals of individual liberty, imagination, and desire, a hatred of bureaucracy and suspicions over the role of government, was the political right. Above all, the movements of the 1960s allowed for the mass revival of free market doctrines that had largely been abandoned since the 19th century. It's no coincidence that the same generation who, as teenagers, made the Cultural Revolution in China was the one who, as 40-year-olds, presided over the introduction of capitalism. Since the 1980s, freedom has come to mean the market, and the market has come to be seen as identical with capitalism, even, ironically, in places like China, which had known sophisticated markets for thousands of years, but rarely anything that could be described as capitalism. The ironies are endless. While the new free market ideology has framed itself above all as a rejection of bureaucracy, it has, in fact, been responsible for the first administrative system that has operated on a planetary scale, with its endless layering of public and private bureaucracies like the IMF, World Bank, WTO and trade organizations, financial institutions, transnational corporations, and NGOs. This is precisely the system that has imposed free market orthodoxy and allowed the openings of the world of financial pillage under the watchful aegis of American arms. It only made sense that the first attempts to recreate a global revolutionary movement, the global justice movement that peaked between 1998 and 2003, was effectively a rebellion against the rule of that very planetary bureaucracy. In retrospect, though, I think that later historians will conclude that the legacy of the 1960s revolution was deeper than we now imagine, and the triumph of capitalist markets and their various planetary administrators and enforcers, which seemed so epochal and permanent in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, was, in fact, far shallower. I'll take an obvious example. One often hears that a decade of anti-war protests in the late 1960s and early 1970s were ultimately failures, since they did not appreciably speed up the U.S. withdrawal from Indochina. But afterward, those controlling U.S. foreign policy were so anxious about being met with similar popular unrest, and even more, with unrest within the military itself, which was generally falling apart by the early 1970s, that they refused to commit U.S. forces to any major ground conflict for almost 30 years. It took 9/11, an attack that led to thousands of civilian deaths on U.S. soil, to fully overcome the notorious Vietnam Syndrome, and even then, those planning the wars placed an almost obsessive effort in making the wars effectively protest-proof. Propaganda was incessant, the media carefully brought on board, experts provided exact calculations on body bag count, how many U.S. casualties it would take to stir mass opposition, and the rules of engagement were carefully written to keep the count below that. The problem was that since those rules of engagement ensured that thousands of women, children, and old people would end up collateral damage in order to minimize deaths and injuries to U.S. soldiers, this meant that in Iraq and Afghanistan, intense hatred for the occupying forces would pretty much guarantee that the United States couldn't obtain its military objectives. And remarkably, the war planners seemed to be aware of this. It didn't matter. They considered it far more important to prevent effective opposition at home than to actually win the war. It's as if American forces in Iraq were ultimately defeated by the ghost of Abby Hoffman. Clearly, an anti-war movement in the 1960s that is still tying the hands of U.S. military planners in 2012 can hardly be considered a failure. But it raises an intriguing question. What happens when the creation of that sense of failure, of the complete ineffectiveness of political action against the system, becomes the chief objective of those in power? The thought first occurred to me when participating in the IMF actions in Washington, D.C. in 2002. Coming shortly on the heels of 9/11, we were relatively few and ineffective, the number of police overwhelming. There was no sense that we could actually succeed in shutting down the meetings. Most of us left feeling vaguely depressed. It was only a few days later, when I talked to someone who had friends attending the meetings, that I had learned we had in fact shut down the meetings. The police had introduced such stringent security measures, canceling half the events, that most of the actual meetings had been carried out online. In other words, the government had decided it was more important for protesters to walk away feeling like failures than for the IMF meetings to actually take place. If you think about it, they are affording protesters extraordinary importance. Is it possible that this preemptive attitude towards social movement, the designing of wars and trade summits in such a way that preventing effective opposition is considered more of a priority than the success of the war or summit itself, really reflects a more general principle? What if those currently running the system, most of whom themselves witnessed the unrest of the 1960s firsthand as impressionable youngsters, are, consciously or unconsciously, and I suspect it's more conscious than not, obsessed by the prospect of revolutionary social movements once again challenging prevailing common sense? It would explain a lot. In most of the world, the last 30 years has come to be known as the age of neoliberalism, one dominated by a revival of the long-since abandoned 19th century creed that held that free markets and human freedom in general were ultimately the same thing. Neoliberalism has always been racked by a central paradox. It declares that economic imperatives are to take priority over all others. Politics itself is just a matter of creating the conditions for growing the economy by allowing the magic of the marketplace to do its work. All other hopes and dreams of equality, of security, are to be sacrificed for the primary goal of economic productivity. But, actually, global economic performance over the last 30 years has been decidedly mediocre. With one or two spectacular exceptions, notably China, which significantly ignored most neoliberal prescriptions, growth rates have been far below what they were in the days of the old-fashioned, state-directed, welfare-state-oriented capitalism of the 1950s, 1960s, and even 1970s. By its own standards, then, the project was already a colossal failure even before the 2008 collapse. If, on the other hand, we stop taking world leaders at their word and instead think of neoliberalism as a political project, it suddenly looks spectacularly effective. The politicians, CEOs, trade bureaucrats, and so forth, who regularly meet at summits like Davos or the G20, may have done a miserable job in creating a world capitalist economy that actually meets the needs of a majority of the world's inhabitants, let alone produces hope, happiness, security, or meaning, but they have succeeded magnificently in convincing the world that capitalism, and not just capitalism, the exact financialized, semi-feudal capitalism we happen to have right now, is the only viable economic system. If you think about it, this is a remarkable accomplishment. How do they pull it off? The preemptive attitude towards social movements is clearly a part of it. Under no conditions can alternatives, or anyone proposing alternatives, be seen to experience success. This helps explain the almost unimaginable investment in security systems of one sort or another, the fact that the United States, which lacks any major rival, spends more on its military and intelligence than it did during the Cold War, along with the almost dazzling accumulation of private security agencies, intelligence agencies, militarized police, guards, and mercenaries. Then there are the propaganda organs, including a massive media industry that did not even exist before the 1960s, celebrating police. Mostly, these systems do not so much attack dissidents directly as contribute to a pervasive climate of fear, jingoistic conformity, life insecurity, and simple despair that renders any thought of changing the world seem an idle fantasy. Yet these security systems are also extremely expensive. Some economists estimate that a quarter of the American population is now engaged in guard labor of one sort or another, defending property, supervising work, or otherwise keeping their fellow Americans in line. Economically, most of the disciplinary apparatus is pure dead weight. In fact, most of the economic innovations of the last 30 years make more sense politically than economically. Eliminating guaranteed life employment for precarious contracts doesn't really create a more effective workforce, but it is extraordinarily effective in destroying unions and otherwise depoliticizing labor. The same can be said of endlessly increasing working hours. No one has much time for political activity if they're working 60-hour weeks. It does often seem that whenever there is a choice between one option that makes capitalism seem the only possible economic system, and another that would actually make capitalism a more viable economic system, neoliberalism means always choosing the former. The combined result is a relentless campaign against the human imagination, or, to be more precise, the imagination, desire, individual liberation, all those things that were to be liberated in the last great world revolution, were to be contained strictly in the domain of consumerism, or perhaps in the virtual realities of the internet. In all other realms, they were to be strictly banished. We are talking about the murdering of dreams, the imposition of an apparatus of hopelessness designed to squelch any sense of alternative future. Yet, as a result of putting virtually all their efforts in the political basket, we are left in the bizarre situation of watching the capitalist system crumbling before our very eyes at just the moment everyone had finally concluded no other system would be possible. Perhaps this is all we could expect in a world where, as I pointed out in Chapter 2, the ruling class on both sides of the ostensible political divide has come to believe there was no reality outside of what could be created by their own power. Bubble economies are one result of the same political program that has only made bribery the sovereign principle running our political system, but for those operating within it, the very principle of reality itself. It's as if the strategy has consumed everything. But this means any revolution on the level of common sense would have devastating effects on those presently in power. Our rulers have gambled everything on making such an outburst of imagination inconceivable. Were they to lose that bet, the effects would be, for them, ruinous. Normally, when one challenges the conventional wisdom that the current economic and political system is the only possible one, the first reaction you are likely to get is a demand for a detailed architectural blueprint of how an alternative system would work, down to the nature of its financial instruments, energy supplies, and policies of sewer maintenance. Next, one is likely to be asked for a detailed program of how the system will be brought into existence. Historically, this is ridiculous. When has social change ever happened according to someone's blueprint? It's not as if a small circle of visionaries in Renaissance Florence, conceived of something they called capitalism, figured out the details of how the stock exchange and factories would someday work, and then put in place a program to bring their visions into reality. In fact, the idea is so absurd, we might well ask ourselves how it ever occurred to us to imagine this is how change happens to begin. My suspicion is that it's really a hangover from Enlightenment ideas that have long since faded out virtually everywhere except America. It was popular in the 18th century to imagine that nations were founded by great lawgivers, like Lycurgus, Solon, who invented their customs and institutions from whole cloth, much like God was imagined to have created the world, and then, again like God, stepped away to let the machine essentially run itself. The spirit of the laws would thus gradually come to determine the character of the nation. It was a peculiar fantasy, but the authors of the U.S. Constitution believed that was how great nations were founded, and actually attempted to put it into practice. Hence, the United States, a nation of laws and not of men, is perhaps the only one on earth of which this picture is in any sense true. But even in the United States, as we've seen, this is only a very small part of what happened. And later attempts to create new nations and institute political or economic systems from above, the United States' great 20th century rival, the USSR, the only other great nation on earth that was primarily an acronym, is the most frequently cited example here, did not work out particularly well. All this is not to say there's anything wrong with utopian visions, or even blueprints. They just need to be kept in their place. The theorist Michael Albert has worked out a detailed plan for how a modern economy could run without money on a democratic, participatory basis. I think this is an important achievement, not because I think that exact model could ever be instituted in exactly the form in which he describes it, but because it makes it impossible to say that such a thing is inconceivable. Still, such models can only be thought experiments. We cannot really conceive the problems that will arise when we start actually trying to build a free society. What now seem likely to be the thorniest problems might not be problems at all. Others that never even occurred to us might prove devilishly difficult. There are innumerable X factors. The most obvious is technology. This is the reason it's so absurd to imagine activists in Renaissance Italy coming up with a model for a stock exchange in factories. What happened was based on all sorts of technologies they couldn't have anticipated, but which in part only emerged because society began to move in the direction that it did. This might explain, for instance, why so many of the more compelling visions of an anarchist society have been produced by science fiction writers. Ursula K. Le Guin, Starhawk, Kim Stanley Robinson. In fiction, you're at least admitting the technological aspect is guesswork. Myself, I'm less interested in deciding what sort of economic system we should have in a free society than in creating the means by which people can make such decisions for themselves. This is why I spent so much of this book talking about democratic decision-making, and the very experience of taking part in such new forms of decision-making encourages one to look on the world with new eyes. What might a revolution in common sense actually look like? I don't know, but I can think of any number of pieces of conventional wisdom that surely need challenging if we are to create any sort of viable free society. I've already explored one, the nature of money and debt, in some detail in a previous book. I even suggested a debt jubilee, a general cancellation, in part just to bring home that money is really just a human product, a set of promises that by its nature can always be renegotiated. Here I'll list four others.